Congratulations. You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes.
Ooh, and me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
This episode is brought to you by the Compensation Foundation. They've got a new thing out, wouldn't you know it? It's called the Bay Area Artist Report, which is an ongoing anonymous platform for visual artists to report and investigate compensation practices in their field. You can find the Bay Area Artist Report at compensationfoundation.org. You can also fill out the survey. And if you fill out the survey and send us a screenshot of it, you may be eligible. Well, you would be eligible to win an awesome prize because I accidentally got an extra copy of Julia Brian Wilson's new book. So send us the thing. Do the survey. Send us the thing. Or if you can't do the survey because you're not an artist or something, then go ahead and just send us an email. We'll put you in the raffle. Drawing time will be before Christmas. Okay, more on compensation later, but now more regular show.
I went over there, the Contemporary Jewish Museum. I noticed something that I've never noticed before, but I think that's been there the whole time that they've had their place there.
Okay.
When you first walk in, there's an installation in the ceiling.
Oh, on the inside.
Yeah. Obviously. Have you noticed that?
I don't
with
know.
All these globes. Okay, Maysoon's got the hot scoop on that globe thing. Okay, give it to us straight.
It's called Lamp of the Covenant, and it's by an artist named Dave Lane.
And has it been there this whole time?
It's ongoing, so it's probably been up there for a really long time.
Okay.
Attached to an enormous oval of steel are antique objects, world globes, light bulbs, tools such as 19th century apple peelers and blowtorches, and various other objects that suggest the unfolding marvels of the cosmos.
Well, that's wild, because I was like, this just jumped out at me, and it's probably been there for 40 years.
Yes,
they got that hallway there, you know, where Kota Ozawa did, and Tony
DeSenza. Yeah, by the bathroom.
Right, and it's kind of like got those glass cabinets that you can, anyhow.
Yeah, display cases.
Allison Smith has a thing in there.
Oh, I missed that one. Okay.
It's really good.
Okay.
Coming to you. It's where a local artist will pair with someone who's not an artist. Oh. And she has done a project with Christina Zetterlund, who is like a craft historian. And so she has like gotten all these kind of found crafts that are responding to like apocalyptic situations.
Oh, wow.
Including yarn tampons and other kinds of things like crafted gun holsters and like other things like craft survival. But because they're like handcrafted, they look kind of twee and like, you know, but then you're like, whoa, this is actually like pointing to like something very disturbing. And I'm just like, God damn, all this apocalyptic shit. The world is definitely going to end. Speaking of which, got my emergency kit. Research assistant Katie Kondo and I got our emergency
kit. What is wrong with me that I still don't fucking have one? I haven't like literally gone on and just been like, I'm going to buy this shit now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be delivered to the house.
And we got to add to ours though, because I think we need some more shit in there. We got the like cheapo one, not the bucket.
You got to get the animal stuff in there.
Oh yeah. And we got to train the cat. So we'll update again. So we'll update again on that. Okay. So anyhow, you got this Jewish folklore show, and now how they did it, like how the show came to be, I guess, was Rennie Pritikin, and I think Pierre, who's leaving, this is his last show as curator there. They sent this book of Jewish folk tales out to a bunch of artists and were basically like, send us back a proposal of a work you'd want to make in response to one of these tales.
Oh, that's cool.
However.
I didn't know that was how they did that.
Yeah, right? So the artists sent it back. The museum got one of the biggest NEA grants they've ever gotten to have this show. Mm-hmm. And they commissioned these works. They paid the artists to, which is awesome,
I think.
That's
great.
And a cool thing about it was that some of the stories are available to the visitors as audio, that you can like listen to the stories as you're going through the show if you want. And then also, I thought this was very interesting. They had someone who was kind of like a tactile interpreter for people that are visually impaired.
Oh, I love that.
Touch the work and then make like an audio guide for people that are visually impaired. Just want to say Julia Goodman's work was excellent, and having her there to speak on it was really, her practice often incorporates this rag paper where she like collects found rags, pulps them, makes paper out of them, which then turn into like sculptures or installations, you know, things, art objects. So anyhow, she has a really big suspended piece where you got to go in and stand in the middle of it because it's
In the middle of it. Felt like I shouldn't do that.
That's the way to do it. 18 in like Jewish numerology is the number of life. So she's got 9 on one side, 9 on the other. It's like these suspended paper with kind of hot, they're kind of holes in the middle and you're kind of looking into this thing. And the story that she's responding to was about this guy who's like walking, he's like a pauper, like back in the day, you know, folk times. And he's just like walking down the road or whatever, and a fucking bird drops this necklace on the ground next to him, and he gets the necklace, so he becomes king.
Whoa.
Right. And so it turns out he's like a really good king. And they're like,
pauper.
Why is he so great? And then it turns out he has this shed built like next to the palace or whatever.
That's where he sleeps.
Where he goes and he puts back on his like pauper clothes, his rags, right? And looks in the mirror in the clothes to like always remind himself of where he came from.
Aww.
And it was really incredible. So the paper installation is meant to kind of be like a reflection. And you can walk into the middle of it and like it's kind of like you're, you know,
right, because it does, it kind of unfolds in the same way in both directions, right? Where it's like bigger and gets sort of smaller in both.
Right, it's kind of mirrored the right. The two hangings of these paper objects. So there was a lot to it. I also didn't know that in like one Jewish mourning tradition that at the funeral, you probably know this. You tear your clothes like on the left side of your body, like where your heart is, you know, as like symbolizing loss.
Cool.
And then you sew it back up again to like for like healing. I thought that was awesome. I think the one of the artists was a photographer named Dina Goldstein. And she, do you know her?
No, I don't.
And she
did she have the black and white photographs?
Yes,
along a pretty long wall.
Yes. And they were really freaky.
I can't remember which story she was responding to.
There was
to,
all kinds. There was Gollum. She did a whole bunch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There was like a lot of people did with the Gollum because I think that's a fun thing to do.
Well, it might. Yeah. It also might feel like it's more open for interpretation, right?
That
if it's a
too.
Monster, it's like, how do you.
Yeah. But they're not always monsters. They're good guys sometimes. They're kind of like the oldest idea of a robot.
Oh, really?
Kind of, because like you can make, so a Gollum.
Is that your interpretation or
well,
how
no,
it was
I mean,
framed
people
there?
Have
curious.
Said that other than me.
No, no, either way, I'm up for it. I'm curious.
But like, so it's like you make, so a Gollum is like an anthropomorphic being that's made from inanimate material like clay or mud or whatever. And then they can be bad, they can be good. But it's funny, and so three or four of the artists were responding to golems, because I just think that's such a great metaphor for just art. Like you're making this thing that has a life beyond you, and it's like going and doing something in the world.
Yeah.
But anyhow, this one photographer had some real freaky shit, and one was like, I think there was one that was based on this other weird thing in Jewish folklore called a dibbuk. It's like a spirit that can possess you, but it's not a demon, it's like a ghost. And the dibbuk is the bad one, and then there's another one that's the good one that I forget the name of. But anyhow, I think the photograph that she did for that, and I could be wrong, was like this lady's basically like in a hospital room giving birth, and there's like this like black smoke thing coming out of her vagina.
Wow.
And going into her mouth, like a big circle. Or maybe it's going out of her mouth and into her vagina? Questions. So many questions. But the photographs were real freaky.
They're both places where things go out and in. Weird. Well, it also implies some kind of circular motion, right?
Yeah, big time. I also saw the Walker Evans show over there at the SF MoMA.
Did you see the soundtrack show?
Yeah, but I saw the Walker Evans show also, and Walker Evans is not gay. Who knew?
Did you think he was gay?
There were some pictures in there like of some sailors and stuff where I'm like, this guy could be
gay. This guy's
gay. But I got the inside scoop from somebody who works there who will remain nameless. Also inside scoop, it was curated Well, the curator who was at SF MoMA Now was at the Pompidou and first showed at the Pompidou.
Oh, so this is curated by the new what do we call him? Senior curator of photography?
Uh-huh. And his name is Clément Chéreau. He's the new senior curator Clément. Of photography.
Yep. Okay, cool.
But he did it over at the Pompidou, and I feel like you kind of can tell there's a little Frenchness to it.
What? Is that just because you read Pompidou as you're entering into the...
No, because there was like some things where they have like other French photographer photographs with
his, to show like influence stuff.
And also like some Hollywood. Of the didactics that are kind of like explaining America. Like America's built around its roadways, like blah, blah, blah. Like... It seems a little like French, and this is credit to one of my inside scooper that, yeah, you kind of can tell. I don't know if I really would have got that if I hadn't been kind of talking about it with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was, it just went on forever.
The show went on
forever? Yes. There's so much work in it, and it goes into two different galleries, and it's like.
Wait, does it cross the gallery, or does it just in that
there's
small?
There's like a big chunk. Up there where the Dion Arbus was, and then another chunk over in like where the photography stuff usually is. They also had like these vinyl blow-ups of some of the photographs, and then had the photographs, framed photographs
on top
uh-huh. there, like hanging from the wall that the vinyl is on. That felt weird to me too. I don't know. There were some choices in there that I just was like, meh. But there was a really interesting video piece that's new up there. There was a new video up there by an artist named Carrie Tribe, which they commissioned. Oh, yeah. Do you know about that?
I'm thinking of a different tribe. Sorry.
I think so. It's like a really weird two-sided, two-channel video where like you only can see one at a time because they're projected like back to back. You know what I'm saying? So okay. There's like a suspended screen in the middle being projected from both sides. Mm-hmm. And you only can see one side at a time. And it's like recreating like these, I think they actually were happening where doctors go and do simulated visits with patients when they're training to become doctors.
Okay.
Where like the patient has like a script of what they're supposed to say.
Like what their symptoms are or.
Yeah. And like, especially like touchy ones where like someone's getting diagnosed with Alzheimer's or like herpes, like things that are really hard. And so, you know, it was really interesting. One side is like script and like documentation and like the forms that are getting filled out by the fake patients. And then the other side, you're actually seeing the visit. It's mm-hmm. like recorded on video. And it was very interesting and weird and definitely worth the $0 I paid to go in. It's just really a kind of uncanny because you're seeing like a many layers of like, is this being restaged by the artist
right.
with found like documentation? Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the actual doctors and it seems fake because they have shitty like people to come in and play the patients, plus right. the doctors know they're being filmed,
so well plus it's all an act anyhow.
Yeah, it all seems like a weird simulacrum.
Yeah
so a simulacrum then.
Where was that?
That is on the fourth floor.
Oh, it's in like the new works space.
Anyhow, point is Carrie Tribe, I'd give that a 8.5 out of 10.
Oh, cool.
But a strong one. And Walker Evans, didn't love it. I'm giving it a 6. He's cool, but like shit, you know. The other guy they had in there was this French photographer from the 1800s named Adjei. I forget his first name, but he was instrumental in like the proto gentrification of Paris when they were doing housemanization, which was like basically gentrification, and he would go and take photographs of like dilapidated buildings.
Oh,
but
no.
People were living there, but he made them look abandoned. Like he'd kind of do like proto editing of the pictures to get the people out to make it be like, look how fucked up these
was
buildings
he working
are.
With like
yeah with
oh
like
my God.
Dudes that were going to come in and redo the city.
Was that information provided in the exhibition?
No.
Or was that something
because
you've
it wasn't
sort of
really
looked
that
in?
Wasn't really the context of why they were showing it. It was more like, look, Walker Evans took pictures of storefronts too.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that in my class with Julia Bryan Wilson,
oh.
who's giving a talk on Saturday at the lab with Helen Molesworth.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Maysoon, you were out in LA this last weekend for Common Field.
I was.
Give us the scoop.
I was down there I was down there with three other members of 100 Days Action. We were invited to be on a panel about how artists respond to cultural emergency. So Common Field, just for those of you who don't know, is they have like a really good one-liner here that's helpful for me. It's a national network of independent visual arts organizations and organizers. They founded it in 2013. Courtney Fink, former director of Southern Exposure, is a co-founder, along with another person whose name I cannot remember. My apologies.
And Stephanie.
So the Common Field started in 2013, and I think the convening started in 2015. And so I think they have over 700 members. So these are arts organizations, like SOEX is a member of Common Field, but also individual artists can also be members. And so the convening is an opportunity to bring all those people together to discuss issues that are, you know, impacting the art world or artists directly. And so it was two full days of sessions. The organization of it was, I think, done really well. They fed us all throughout the day, which is amazing. Like there was, you know, breakfast, a full-on lunch, like catered by local LA, you know, chefs or food artists, however you want to call that.
Oh yeah.
and one part that was interesting was on the first, so it was Friday and Saturday were the main conference days, although they did have a pre-conference day on Thursday that we missed. That I think was about cultural and racial equity in the arts. But on Friday night, they did this thing for dinner where they split up the entire, like all of the conference attendees into groups of 20. There were 20 spaces throughout LA where you would go for dinner. So like one group of 20 would go to this one artist's house studio and have dinner there. Some things that stand out to me about the conference, and I don't know why this was hitting me so hard. I think I spend a lot of time in my life with women, but white male privilege is a real fucking thing. I mean, I know that we all know that, but it just was like punching me in the face at the conference, just like really recognizing, even though I think at the beginning of each of like, so they would do these sessions where every morning it would be like the entire conference would meet in this theater and there was some session. And
I'm getting fired up already.
At the beginning of all of those sessions, Courtney or other people would always make announcements of like being aware of your privilege, whoever you are, be aware of your privilege and try your hardest to let people who maybe don't have opportunities to talk.
Yeah.
Right.
To take like space and make space.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So they were being super mindful of that and like making announcements when they could about just reminding folks to do that. And in our panel in particular, this one guy who meant well, of course people mean well in a conference like this.
Yeah.
But he was so unaware of his like white male privilege, like male man spreading, not physically man spreading, but just like the male privilege spreading all over the fucking place. we were supposed to break out into groups. Like we were supposed to all present for 10 minutes. Like, and I like timed, you know, I like was up until 1 a.m, like timing my fucking presentation to make sure I was like 10 minutes or less to be like respectful of everyone else who was there. It's like, duh, that's what you fucking do. And we were all within that. This one guy gets up, goes on for 30 fucking plus 40 maybe minutes. And it's like, you know, it was just BS. It was really annoying. And, you know, our moderator did try multiple times to tell him that was enough. But then there was this moment, multiple moments also throughout the weekend where I was sort of like, why are we so afraid of, I don't want to say conflict, but just like, why couldn't I just get up in that moment and be like, you know what? I think it's time for you to stop now. Like, how would it is? I know it's rude sounding, but like there's a moment where we have to put ourselves out on the line. Right. And just interrupt some motherfucker and be like, you need to sit down now.
Fuck.
You know what I mean? And so just like thinking about that real, like how do we get comfortable with the idea of discomfort? Right. Like that's a real thing in the world right now. And how do you put yourself, like, if you're someone who experiences privilege like I do in certain ways, like, how do I fucking just use that to, like, whereas someone else maybe cannot for other reasons? I just think that's a real thing. It came up many times throughout the conference. And this, in a similar vein, there was another session I was sitting in where I was sitting behind an older white man who was probably a director of an organization who, like, was very calculated about, you know, there's one point where people were asking questions and the moderator's like, okay, you're first and you're second, then you're third. And he happened to be first in that grouping. And he was like, oh no. And he literally let the other two people who happened to be women ask their questions first. He did that multiple times throughout this session. I was sort of like, okay, so we have two white men who are in like opposite worlds, right? Like one guy who's so not aware of his own privilege and like his spreading all over the fucking place. And one guy who's like really working hard. And it's like, I almost wanted to like say thank you to him, but I didn't because I don't think he needed.
Right.
I also don't need to be thanking white men for paying the fuck attention because they should already be paying attention at this point. Anyhow. So there were some of those things that was happening. There was this really interesting panel called, okay, so this is called Institutional Listening. And it was basically addressing, you know, the issues that came up this year around like the Whitney and the Dana Schutz piece or the Walker and the Sam Durant piece. There was also a piece by this artist named Kelly Walker. At the St. Louis Museum.
Oh, I remember that.
Which I didn't actually hear of, and that sounds like a whole total mess. So they were addressing like how institutions need to respond in these moments, and what's the responsibility of the artist making.
It seems like institutional listening would have prevented those things from happening in the first place.
Right. Totally. So that was an interesting. That was probably for me the most interesting panel. Sarah Shulman is pretty incredible. I want to encourage everyone to read her if you haven't yet, because I think she's just like radical. We talked about like capitalism and how that's fucking shit up, of course.
Do we have a little clip of that?
Reflecting back on the open casket fight at the Whitney, which I think more is what you're interested in. One of my observations of we had a huge discussion at the Whitney. There were eight of us on the panel. Malik was one of them, and the audience was unbelievable. I mean, like, Lorna Simpson was there, and Lorraine O'Grady was there, and Malia Obama was there. It was quite an audience. And the thing that really emerged, my perception of the discussion, was that we have this idea that the only way we acknowledge people's pain is by going to the source of the pain and punishing it. Mm. We linked punishment to the experience of being seen and acknowledged. So the curators, I think, I'm projecting this onto them, but what I saw was that they felt they had to defend their choices. And for them, defending their choices meant not acknowledging the fact that viewing those images was distinctly painful for some black viewers in a way that Asian and white viewers did not experience. And that you have to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. You may not come to the same punishment conclusion that the work should be destroyed, but maybe it should be destroyed or it shouldn't. That's another discussion. But it was put into an either-or binary, that if you acknowledge that to quote, that black suffering was used as entertainment, if you acknowledge that that is the fact, and I believe that is the fact, it does not mean that you have to then take down the painting. There's a whole bunch of territory in between those two points, but people were afraid to acknowledge that that was so. And I think that that information is the key information that came from that event that we all now have to internalize.
I think going back into the context of St. Louis, it wasn't necessarily that the artist could not talk about the work. He talked about the processes of the work. He talked about the materials very eloquently, but there was that elephant in every single piece that almost every single piece in two of the galleries, two or three of the galleries, depicted black bodies undergoing some type of suffering and having those experiences be further leveled or layered with additional crises. And when questioned, when probed by other artists like Khalil Irving, like Damon Davis, like other people just in the audience, it wasn't necessarily that he couldn't answer, but he chose to dismiss it. And same with the curator. The curator at the time was someone who was known for being eloquent and provocative in how he would depict and curate particular shows and hard subjects. We had so many exhibitions that had no type of controversy because there was a boldness to step into it. But when it came to those racial moments, to talking about why is there a 1964 archival image of a black man getting nearly bitten by a dog with white chocolate, dark chocolate, and milk chocolate smeared on his body in a triptych? If you can't answer that, as that piece is right across from a floor-to-ceiling image of the rapper Trina with God knows what smear all across her, a white toothpaste it was Aquafresh toothpaste smeared across her body, and then beside that there's a white-on-white print of Michael Jackson being arrested, and then there's the Little Richard pieces of him being in these moments of intense suffering and pain and embarrassment. There is something there that drives an artist to continue to want to plague or have inquiry into the suffering, the embarrassment, these moments about another race. And to not articulate that, I think that was part of what drove a lot of the challenges and controversies that came up. And so I think, yes, artists, I believe that artists have every right to express whatever we want to. And we should have the ability to stand behind our work and face it, to face the intentions, the motivations, the underlining of what we are creating, especially when it regards a public. These were works that, when shown in New York, when shown in other spaces, did not have that type of controversy. But St. Louis is a very unique space. This is a city or a region that is so divided into so many municipalities that the challenges are just tangled into this ball of yarn. And the trauma of recent issues in Ferguson and St. Louis was still very fresh in 2016, just, you know, a year and a half or two, almost 2 years later. And so I think in terms of the organization itself, there's this notion of, are we going to be tone deaf? Are we going to ignore what's here? Or are we going to really listen to the tone and the energy of where the work is being shown?
So the people who were on the panel were this woman, Dean Nichols, who works at she's like the director of education and community outreach at the St. Louis Museum. Harry Gamboa Jr., who's an artist and who also teaches, I can't remember at what school in LA, he's a teacher. And then Sarah Schulman, who she's a writer, but she's also on, Claudia Rankin's. Claudia Rankin has like a foundation where, you know, they responded to the Dana Schutz piece. But so Sarah Schulman was part of that, like organizing that group discussion and also presented as well. Mm-hmm. I think what was exciting for us as the 100 Days Action was that we made a lot of connections to artists and arts organizations outside of the West Coast. We've been thinking a lot about this question of like preaching to the choir, like you're in the bubble. How do we actually do stuff outside of our direct community? And, you know, it seems like partnering with other organizations or other artists doing work across the country would be an interesting way of doing that. And so that's pretty exciting for us.
And final score?
Final score for the conference, 7-8.
That's solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Like I felt
there's
like
always room for improvement.
Always room for improvement. I would definitely, I felt like I wanted to go to the, I want to go to next year's also. Like I want to continue.
Well, you know where I'll be until then.
From the bridge?
To the other bridge.
To the island in between.
This has been... Congratulations, Pine Tree.